7. A Woman's Heart. Serafima Vitalievna, a young woman so small that it was difficult not to call her Simochka, was an MGB lieutenant. She wore an orange blouse and a warm shawl around her shoulders. The free personnel in this building were all MGB officers. In accordance with the Constitution, free personnel had a great variety of rights, among them the right to work. This right, however, was limited by the 8-hour day and by the fact that their labour created no added value, consisting solely in watching prisoners. Whereas the prisoners, though deprived of all other rights, had an ampler right to work, up to 12 hours a day. During the additional hours, from 6 to 11 p.m., including the supper break, the free personnel of each lab had to take turns supervising the prisoners' work. Today it was Simochka's turn. All power and all authority in the acoustics lab was, for the present, vested in this small, sparrow-like girl. She was supposed to see to it that the prisoners worked and did not slacken, that they did not make use of the workplace to manufacture weapons or try to tunnel out, and that they did not avail themselves of the radio parts abundantly provided to rig up shortwave transmitters. At 10:50 she had to take all secret documentation from them, put it in a big safe, and seal the door of the laboratory. It was not quite 6 months since Simochka had graduated from the Institute of Communications Engineering, and, on the strength of her spotless record, been appointed to this special secret scientific research institute, known only by a number but called by prisoners in their irreverent vernacular a sharashka. Free personnel were given officer's rank as soon as they were taken on, and paid twice the salary of an ordinary engineer, in recognition for their rank and for their uniform. And all that was asked was devotion to duty and vigilance, literacy and professional skills being of secondary importance. This suited Simochka very well. She, and many of her classmates with her, had carried away no knowledge when she left the institute, for a number of reasons. The girls had arrived from school knowing no mathematics and no physics. They had found out in the higher classes that teachers who gave low marks were upbraided by the headmaster at staff meetings, so that you could get your graduation certificate without studying at all. Then, in the institute, if there was ever time for it, the girls sat down to work at their math and radio technology as if they were lost in a bewildering, pathless, alien forest. More often than not, there just wasn't time to study. For a month and more every autumn, students were whisked off to collective farms to dig potatoes, so that for the rest of the year they had 8 or even 10 lectures a day, with no time to go over their notes. Monday was political education day, and there would be another compulsory meeting of some sort later in the week. Then social work. Wall newspapers, amateur concerts, help out at home, do the shopping, wash, change your clothes, an evening at the movies, the theatre, the club. If you can't have fun, can't dance a bit in your student days, you may never get another chance. Young people aren't meant to work themselves to death. To Simochka and her friends, preparation for exams meant preparing a lot of crib sheets, hiding them in articles of female attire inaccessible to males, then retrieving the necessary piece of paper in the exam room, smoothing it out, and pretending that it was rough work produced on the spot. The examiners could, of course, have shown up the inadequacy of their students' knowledge by supplementary questions, but they were overburdened themselves with committee work, open meetings, proliferating plans, progress reports to the dean and to the rector, so that redoing the exam would have been one chore too many. What is more, they would have been under attack for a high failure rate, just as though they had turned out defective goods in a factory. Someone would have quoted Krupskaya, was it? To the effect that there are no bad pupils, only bad teachers. The examiners therefore did their best not to shoot the candidates down, but to bring the exam to the quickest and most favourable conclusion. As senior students, Simochka and her friends admitted to themselves with dismay that they still had no great liking for their chosen profession, and indeed found it tiresome. But it was too late to change. Simochka shuddered at the thought of working in a factory. Then, suddenly, she found herself at Marfino. What pleased her about the place from the start was that she was given no independent work assignment. But you didn't have to be a frail little thing like Simochka to feel uneasy entering the confines of this isolated fortress beyond the city limits, where hand-picked guards and security officers kept watch over major political offenders. They had all been briefed together, all 10 girl graduates of the Institute of Communications Engineering. They were informed that they had landed in a place worse than any battlefield, a snake pit, in which one careless move could mean disaster. They were told that they would be meeting the dregs of humanity, people unworthy of the Russian language that they so unfortunately spoke. They were warned that these people were especially dangerous, because they never bared their fangs, but invariably wore a false mask of politeness and good breeding. And if you questioned them about their crimes, which was expressly prohibited, they would try by an ingenious tissue of lies to represent themselves as innocent victims. The girls were instructed that they in turn should not vent their hatred on these reptiles, but make an outward show of politeness, without, however, entering into discussions of anything except the work at hand, never accepting messages for the outside world. And at the very first breach of regulations, suspicion of a breach, or possibility of suspecting a breach, they must hurry along to the security officer, Major Shikin. Major Shikin, a short, dark-complexioned, self-important man with bristling, greying hair on his large head and small feet in boy-sized shoes, added the thought that although the reptilian interior of these malefactors was as clear as could be to experienced people like himself, there might possibly be among inexperienced girls like these new arrivals one who, in the mistaken kindness of her heart, could commit a breach of regulations by, for instance, lending a prisoner a book from the employee's library. Not to mention mailing a letter, because any letter, whatever Maria Ivanovna it was addressed to, would inevitably be sent on to an American spy center. Major Shikin earnestly begged the girls, if they saw one of their number fall, to come to her rescue like true friends by frankly informing Major Shikin what had happened. In conclusion, the Major did not conceal the fact that a liaison with a prisoner was punishable under the criminal code, which, as everyone knows, is sufficiently elastic to include sentences of 25 years' hard labor. It was impossible to contemplate the joyless years ahead of them without a shudder. Some of the girls, indeed, had tears in their eyes. But the seeds of distrust had been sown, and as they left the briefing session they talked about other matters, not about what they had just heard. More dead than alive, Simochka had followed engineer Major Reutemann into the acoustics lab, at first hardly daring to open her eyes. That was 6 months ago, and since then something strange had happened to Simochka. No, her belief in the dark machinations of imperialism had not been shaken. Nor was it any less easy for her to suppose that the prisoners working in all the other rooms were blood-stained criminals. But in the dozen Zeks whom she met daily in the acoustics lab, people gloomily indifferent to freedom, to their own lot, to the 10 years or the quarter century of imprisonment before them, the scholars, the engineers and design fitters preoccupied day in and day out with nothing but the work that was not their own, pointless work, which would bring them not a penny in earnings or a smidgen of fame. In these people she strove in vain to detect the notorious international criminals so easily recognized by the moviegoer and so deftly ferreted out by Soviet counter-espionage. Simochka had no fear of them. Nor could she find it in herself to hate them. These people inspired in her nothing but unqualified respect for the range of their knowledge and the stoicism with which they bore their misfortune. And for all the alarm bells of her Komsomol conscience, however much love of the fatherland nagged at her to report every trick and misdemeanor on the part of prisoners to the security officer, for some inexplicable reason Simochka had begun to feel that it would be unthinkably mean to do so. It was even more obviously impossible where her nearest neighbor and fellow worker was concerned, Gleb Nyazhin, who sat facing her over their two desktops. Simochka had worked closely with him ever since her arrival, assigned to assist him in carrying out experiments on articulation. The Marfino Sharashka was required from time to time to assess the quality of voice reproduction over particular telephone circuits. Excellent as their equipment was, No instrument had yet been invented which would indicate this by the movement of a needle. Only the voice of a speaker reading out separate syllables, words, and phrases, and the ears of listeners trying to pick up the text at the other end of the line, could provide a measurement in terms of the incidence of error. These experiments were what they called articulation tests. Nerzhin was busy, at least he was meant by his superiors to be busy, looking for the optimum mathematical programming of these tests. They were going well, and Nerzhin had even put together a 3-volume monograph on their methodology. When he and Simochka had a great accumulation of work to get through, Nerzhin would establish priorities and give firm instructions. His face looked so youthful as he did so that Simochka, who thought of war as it was shown in the movies, pictured Nerzhin at such moments in his captain's uniform, in the midst of cannon smoke, his light brown hair wind-blown, shouting out, "Fire!" to his battery. A scene seldom omitted in war movies. But if Nerzhin wanted things done in a hurry, it was in order to put the obvious tasks behind him and avoid further effort for as long as possible. He had once said as much to Simochka. "I'm active because I hate activity." "What do you like, then?" she asked timidly. "Thinking." And, in fact, once the flurry of work abated, he would sit for hours, hardly changing his position, looking old, grey-faced, and haggard. Where was his self-assurance now? He was slow and irresolute. He pondered lengthily before adding a sentence or two to the minutely written notes that Simochka could, not for the first time, see among the untidy heap of reference books and technical articles. She had even noticed that he tucked them away somewhere on the left-hand side of his desk, but not, apparently, in a drawer. Simochka felt faint with curiosity. What was he writing? And for whom? Nerzhin had unwittingly become the focus of her compassion and rapt admiration. Simochka's girlhood had held nothing but unhappiness so far. She was not pretty. Her looks were spoiled by a nose much too long, and hair that had refused to grow out, gathered now into a skimpy bun at the back. She was not just small, she was extremely small, and her figure was that of a 14-year-old schoolgirl rather than a grown woman. She was, moreover, straight-laced, averse to jokes and frivolity, which made her still less attractive to young men. So it was that in her 23rd year no one had ever courted her, hugged her, or kissed her. Then, just a month ago, something had gone wrong with the microphone in the testing booth. Nerzhin called Simochka over to fix it, and she had come into the booth holding a screwdriver. In the soundproof and airless, confined space, where there was scarcely room for two people, she had bent over the microphone that Nerzhin was already inspecting, and her cheek had brushed against his. Their cheeks touched, and she froze in horror. What would happen next? She should have pulled away from him, but she continued stupidly inspecting the microphone. It dragged on and on, this most terrifying moment in her life. Their cheeks, close together, were burning, and he didn't move. Then, suddenly, he took her head in his hands and kissed her on the lips. A blissful weakness flooded Simochka's body. What she said at the moment had nothing to do with the Komsomol or the motherland. "The door isn't locked." A flimsy blue blind fluttered between them and the noise outside, the people walking about and talking, who might draw the blind aside and walk in. The prisoner, Nerzhin, was risking nothing except 10 days in the punishment cells. But the girl was putting at risk her clean record, her career, perhaps even her freedom. Yet she hadn't the strength to break loose from the hands that tilted back her head. For the first time in her life, she had been kissed by a man. So the steel chain, forged with such reptilian cunning, snapped at the link that had been fashioned from a woman's heart.